gamble is to gamble away from the vaccine and away from potential harm. Now, Jessica Rose, in her first paper, showed that the non-fatal reactions tend to be cardiovascular, neurologic, and immunologic. They tend to occur quickly after the shot. Again, a tight temporal relationship. And with Rose, she's a really tight epidemiologist, but virologist. She's made the case that we've completely fulfilled the Bradford Hill criteria for causality. We have a dangerous mechanism of action. We have a tight temporal relationship. We have internal consistency between death and the non-fatal events. We have external consistency because this is seen in the MHRA system, the yellow card system, and in the UDRA, UA, the EMA system. We basically got it. We have fulfilled Hill's tenets of causality. The vaccine is causing these events. Myocarditis, pericarditis, official FDA warnings. We are at astronomical numbers of hospitalizations, ER visits, etc. We're at, shockingly, 26,000 Americans now permanently disabled after the vaccines that the CDC is telling us. Permanently disabled. Now, who answers for that? That's more than a war. That's more than the Iraq war. These are permanently disabled Americans. So death and disability, it's clear, are coming after these vaccines, and they're strongly temporally related. I mean temporally related. It's like a shotgun. It's like a shotgun. We have two separate analyses, one by Rose, one by McLachlan, independent analyses, U.S. Spares data. 50% of these deaths occur within 48 hours. 50%, 80% within a week. It's a no wonder people are protesting. No wonder you have to take a vaccine. People are saying, wait a minute, I see this. I'm on the internet. I could die. Employees are saying, I don't want to take the vaccine because I could die. It's not that I'm anti-vax. It's just I don't want to die. Isn't that okay that I don't want to die? No wonder there's tension. I mean, come on, think about it. We have 20 million kids who go off to college every year. They take the meningococcal vaccine. You haven't seen any protests over the meningococcal vaccine. I'm a doctor. I take hepatitis B and influenza vaccine. Have you seen people protesting over the hepatitis B vaccine outside hospitals? No. I mean, are there COVID vaccine protests? Of course, because people know that this is an unbelievable shotgun risk. McLachlan, Queen's University in London, analyzed the data. 86% of the deaths with separate independent adjudicators. It has no other explanation. It was the vaccine. And on two occasions now, our CDC has said, three occasions now, I believe, it's March, June, and September, our CDC, in no announcement on their website, has said, CDC and FDA doctors have reviewed all the deaths and none are related to the vaccine. None. Including the ones that happen in the vaccine center and they're doing CPR right there. Nope, not related to the vaccine.
Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
Friday, October 29th, 2021. Thank you for joining me today. It's amazing how much is coming out lately that is just a slam dunk right in your face, obvious reality that's just being dismissed outright because we're supposed to. That's Dr. Peter McCullough that you saw in the opening there. Very, very revealing information. I mean, it's exactly what we've continued to tell you, exactly what we've continued to show you, not just because he said so, but because the data backs that up. It's as simple as that. Now, there's a lot to talk about today. It's going to be actually a focused show on one main or really two main topics. There's a lot that I pushed off today. I had like a four-hour block ready to go and decided to focus on what you see in the title today, because this seems just too important to not miss. Now, we're going to start off talking about specifically Pfizer and the changes that were made and openly discussed right on their own documentation. There's no daylight between this. It's very obvious. They're saying we changed this because of what we're doing in regard to the children's injections to 5 to 11. I'll show it to you myself. And then ask yourself how that even makes sense, how you can change something and change the formulation yet not do safety trials on the new substance, as it's being called a new active substance. We'll go over this stuff. Or actually, I'm conflating something I'm going to talk about tomorrow, actually, in regard to Pfizer, where it seems there are other new changes. They will get to that. I wasn't even going to talk about it, but I mentioned that one point that I shouldn't have brought up. But in this case, this is listed right in their documentation. It's being discussed as, you know, because we're going to make it better. But that requires no more investigation. Anything, any change, especially stuff like you're going to see today. But we're also going to talk about the side effects and what's happening around it and why it shows you that this is very clearly causing problems they don't want you to see. Their data backs that up that they don't want you to talk about. And of course, the fact that the new study, again, another study finds that the unvaccinated, rather, the vaccinated are spreading it just as much as the unvaccinated. Now, that's not exactly what the study says. The study says that they are capable of being just as infectious, which is not new. We've been talking about that from the beginning. But that study and what they find, the data, combined with what they're showing you from their data from the UK and other places, are very clearly showing you that, yes, most cases are in the injected. And if they're just as capable of spreading it, put those two things together and what do you get? It's not hard to see. You see, they only talk about one or the other. Well, of course, there's cases everywhere because most of them are injected, but they're very rarely going to the hospital. Okay, then we jump over to the hospital data. Well, here it shows that most of them are in the hospital. Well, of course they are because most of them are injected, but the deaths are super rare. And we jump over to the deaths and it's like, well, look, most of them are dying or injected. Well, of course, because most of them are injected. It's like, wait a minute. Like, where's the logic here? We're just jumping from point to point without really standing back and realizing that all of it shows you that it's all happening in one spot. This is why we talk about mass psychosis, because it's just in your face. It really is. Now, we're also going to talk about the FDA panel that approved this for 5 to 11 based on the data we're seeing today, and why that's criminal is the best word for it, because they saw this stuff. Now, to start off, I want to again show you start off with showing you the interview that Taylor Hudak had with Dr. Peter McCullough, who was speaking in the beginning, and he goes over a lot of the stuff that you're going to want to listen to, some of the stuff he touched on there in the beginning, that it's very clear what you're seeing. I hope you'll check that out for yourself. Now, on his points, I want to share something with you that confirms what he's saying. Not just the fact that this is causing problems that they're hiding, but specifically in regard to Comirnaty, Pfizer, and then Australia, but specifically around the one problem that we know they've at least grudgingly admitted to is focused on the group they just approved for injections, myocarditis. Now, trust me, when you get into all of it, it's outrageous. Like I've been jokingly saying, how many rare things can you pile up before it becomes no longer rare, statistically speaking, like the complete risk, right? Each of them come along with a certain percentage. And if you have all of them, it's 2%, 2%, you add them all together, well, suddenly you've got a pretty large percentage of risks that are possible all at the same time. The reality, though, is that they're just hiding this from you. But myocarditis is a very clear one that stands out among all of them. And even they have grudgingly had to be like, yes, it's more than normal, but it's okay because they'll get better, even though the data does not back that up either. As we've shown you many times, myocarditis comes along with a potential 25 to 56% increase in mortality, potential death, between the next 3 and 10 years. That's non-serious cases of myocarditis. All of what the children are dealing with right now. No, it went away by 2 days. They're good. Except it goes along with that increase for the next possible 10 years. But they don't want to tell you that. That's in an NIH study, peer-reviewed. But we don't talk about stuff before COVID-19 clown world began. Here is from Australian government. COVID-19 vaccine weekly safety report. This is as of yesterday, the 28th. 3 COVID-19 vaccines are currently in use in Australia. I just want to focus on the Pfizer because this is the one. Moderna's there too, but this is the one we're discussing today. And this, I'm using this in the context of the 5 to 11 approval that just happened. And yes, it is an approval because it was, well, technically it still has to wait for Walensky to sign off, but the panel has suggested it. And then as of today, the FDA said it was going forward. It's just incredible to me that this is even where we are with everything we know, even before we get into the stuff today. They're not at risk. They're not spreading it. That thing increases their risk of myocarditis by a much greater factor than they increase their risk by living or having the risk of very small risk of COVID-19, which then brings some kind of a risk, they argue, of myocarditis. But that's 1 in 1 million, or rather 1 in 100, whatever it was. I forgot the actual data. 1 in 1 million chance they have of dying. That's 19-year-olds and below. In regard to hospitalization and everything else, it's far, far, far below the flu. And yet we're going to give them something that potentially gives them a up to 50% increase in mortality over the next 10 years if they get myocarditis, which, don't forget, is a very high, it's dramatically increased over the normal time frame. And see, you see the difference between those two things is you have to catch COVID first to be able to have the risk they claim comes along with COVID-19. On the other side of it, it's immediate. It's injected in your arm and boom, you've got that risk and it's dramatically increased. See the difference? It's a false choice. They pretend like they're equal and they're not. But going forward, it says, summary, we are carefully monitoring and reviewing reports of myocarditis and pericarditis following mRNA injections, particularly in younger groups, even as we tell everybody to get it in those younger groups, thrombosis with thrombocytopenia syndrome. Remember when all of this was fake news? Remember when all of this stuff was completely unbearable? We don't know for sure. Well, now they've told you it all. Just always dance back to that moment when we were being censored for not saying it's everywhere, not saying it's guaranteed, simply saying it's possible. Fake news, dangerous misinformation, and now here we are. Over and over and over. Guillain-Barré syndrome, immune thrombocytopenia. Myocarditis is known, it says, but very rare side effect. How are they even possibly using the term rare? They've admitted that it's not rare. It's not rare if it's exponentially an increased risk after injection. If you're expecting 19 cases and you get 230, that's not rare. And they know that, but here we are. They continue to use the word rare because they know they're supposed to. To October 24th, the TGA has received 235 reports, which have been assessed as likely to be myocarditis from approximately 21 million doses of Comirnaty. Now, that's not the most important part. That's enough for me, but this is the most important part. That number is an increase of 60 cases just in the last week. I guess they missed that part in their reporting. That should be the headline. 60 cases of myocarditis in the last week. What happened in the last week? A dramatic increase in injections for those age groups that we are very concerned about. But just who cares about that because it's only 60? This is outrageous, and they keep jumping from one stone to the next and pointing back and saying, whoa, it's not as dangerous as the thing we keep pointing to over there that we haven't confirmed yet. This is dangerous. That is dangerous. And that is increasing the risk of the people who have the least amount of risk. I don't know why anybody thinks this is acceptable. Now, you're going to hear other people in the panel as well saying it's not, specifically, as usual, from the open forum portion. But as we go forward, realize that this risk is clear and they just don't want to talk about it. Now, this is why I included this image today. Now, just to understand, for those in the podcast, it says on a side of a bus, in Whitby, kids have strokes too. Know the warning signs. Now, we've talked about the previous discussion from the mainstream media going, did you know how many kids have heart problems in this country? I didn't either. It's a lot. It's like weird how that's perfectly timed to kind of overlap with the things that are being caused by the injections, which are heart problems. I guess that was just coincidence. Now, here's the interesting part about this, though. This has been going on for a long time. Just for full disclosure, as you will always get on this show, I could have just left it alone and let everybody think, oh my gosh, that's all, which is what most people do today. This has been around since 2015 because I did my due diligence, at least as far back as I could see. Johns Hopkins has a thing about kids having strokes too back in 2015. But what I don't see up until now is being on the side of a bus, right? Really, are we going to pretend that it's that much of, it's not actually, the risk is not that much. And here's what the information they have down here, 5 per 100,000. But it's been discussed. It happens. Okay. So we were told. Maybe that back then was because of a vaccine too. Who knows? But the point here is that this is being shoved into your face now in a way that has never been before. That's usually reserved for things that are far more relevant. And to me, that screams we're getting ready for something we see coming. That's my opinion. Think about it for yourself. But that's why I wanted to use that, because it's just right on the side of the bus saying, guess what? You know, when you see these kids having strokes that are perfectly healthy right after injections, that's because they have strokes too. Self-serving. On top of that, before we jump into the first part about this being changed for 5 to 11s, recognize, don't forget, that Sweden has a suspended Moderna shot because of the crippling heart conditions, which, by the way, are far more seen in Pfizer than Moderna. Just remember that, because Pfizer is what's being predominantly used in the United States, and specifically what just got approved for emergency authorized, excuse me, like they treat them differently for 5 to 11 year olds. Also ask yourself how in the world they're allowed to keep emergency authorizing things when, one, we're not in emergency, and two, they have an approved product they're using. or excuse me, again, excuse me, all the lies they're spinning, I'm forgetting on myself. They're not using that they're pretending they're using while keeping it in the background, which apparently not even producing until November, which is just ridiculous. For those that are confused about all of that, I'm not even going to get into it today because it is a nonsensical, intentionally confusing narrative. They're manipulating your information, giving you things that are still emergency authorized while pretending there's an approved product out there because of whatever narrative they justify that with. But understand that these things are hurting children. And there are places around the world that have stopped it entirely, more than just Sweden. I'm forgetting the other ones off the top of my head. Suspending these shots because they're dangerous. Remember that in 2009, excuse me, with the swine flu, which we'll touch on in a moment, 53 unreported deaths in VAERS. Same situation. VAERS reports. That's all they were. 53. Paused the whole program. So why today, when we've got over 18,000 unconfirmed VAERS reports in the same vein, why suddenly it's not valid, or at least concerning, or at least a signal, right? None of that. All of it's fake because we just don't talk about it. It's just never been this obvious how dishonest and criminal these people are. But on this note, B Lady, thank you for sharing this. This is actually, I believe this is, yes, I believe, I don't know why I'm not following her actually. That's why I didn't notice that. This is, unless she got a new account. Anyway, this is somebody you're probably familiar with. I've been on the Union of the Unwanted with her. Recommend following her channel. So good catch by her on this. Make sure you follow her account here. Pfizer changed their formulation for 5 to 11-year-olds. They added thromethamine, a blood acid reducer that is used to stabilize people with heart attacks. Side effects? Respiratory depression, IV thrombosis, and more. What do you know? Now, don't trust her. Don't trust me. Don't trust anything other than the documentation. And even then, consider that they could be lying to you always. The point is that this is coming from them. This is the FDA briefing document as of October 26th. Here is what it says. Vaccine formulation. Authorization is being requested for modified formulation of the Pfizer BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. Now, first of all, recognize that. That seems to suggest that they're requesting to modify the current formulation in general, which, by the way, would require more safety testing, which they won't do, and they haven't. They didn't do it this time, because here's the next point. I just want to make sure you see that first part, because that's where this is going. It says next, to provide a vaccine with an improved stability profile. First of all, ask yourselves why we need an improved stability profile if it's perfectly safe and effective, right? The Pfizer BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine, which again, recognize that means the emergency authorized version, not the Comirnaty, because that's not called Pfizer BioNTech COVID-19. That's called Comirnaty. That's the difference. So the emergency authorized substance for use in children 5 to 11, which they've been using, but that's the point, of age uses of thromamine buffer instead of phosphate buffering saline as used in the previous formulation and excludes sodium chloride and potassium chloride. There's no way to misunderstand what they're saying there. They changed what's in this to provide improved stability for this exact purpose. For children 5 to 11, they use thromamine instead of phosphate buffered saline. That is incredible that no one's talking about this, that other than the Bee Lady, nobody's talking about this in the mainstream. It's right there in their documentation. How do you not report on this? Here is what thromamine solution looks like. Well, first, let's just check. We'll look at what she shared here. First of all, showing you this. It is used to treat or prevent acid problems in blood. Interesting, all this blood connection stuff, right? For the consumer, side effects. Respiratory depression, local irritation, tissue inflammation. Looks about the same as what we're looking over here. Let's check it out on this page I found. Thromamine solution for injection. Makes blood and urine more alkaline and less acidic. It's used to treat metabolic acidosis, a condition where the body produces too much acid or when the kidneys are not removing enough acid from the body. So why is that being added to an injection for 5 to 11-year-olds that really don't need it? Is that going to somehow reduce the problems they know are happening yet are not admitting? Or maybe it's making it worse. I mean, ultimately, who gets to decide? We don't get to vote or talk about it or even get to have a free, open, objective discussion about it. They just do things. No safety trials. What should I tell my healthcare provider before I take this medicine? Check this out. They need to know if you have these conditions. Kidney disease, respiratory acidosis, salicylate toxicity in a newborn, an unusual or allergic reaction to thromamine or other medicines. So apparently people aren't even being told this is in this injection, and people need to be asked, are you allergic to this substance? Pregnant or trying to get pregnant? Yeah, but they're offering this to pregnant women. Well, first of all, let's be clear. This is, we're talking about the 5211 substance. So pregnant women aren't in this conversation, but are we really going to pretend like they wouldn't be changing other things without really making it clear? I mean, for crying out loud, why are we assuming it's even going to be listed in this document for what we've seen thus far? But we're ignoring for the moment, which I think will be relevant very soon, pregnant women trying to get pregnant, breastfeeding, all of the other things they continue to ignore because their documents as of right now still say we don't have the data to make sure that's safe, and yet they're still telling people that it's safe. But it says kidney disease, respiratory acidosis. So what about all the children out there, 5 to 11, that suffer from problems like this, that have allergic reactions to things like medicines, food dyes, which is like half the population? But sure, let's just jam this into something for children that don't need this and hope that everything works out. That's called experimentation. You are testing on these children, regardless of what you think or what their logic is to it. I don't care if they think they're doing the right thing. This is wrong. All of this is wrong, and it has been from the beginning. What may interact with this medicine? Same thing they're ignoring in the FDA documentation about any of these injections. They're not asking whether they interact with other medications. They're not testing whether they interact with other vaccines. They still haven't. It still says it right on their documentation. We do not know how it interacts. Yet they're offering the flu shot right next to it. They're not asking whether you have injections when they give you this injection. None of this is appropriate. Anybody honest can see that. I don't care whether you want to label people anti-vax or not. If you heard what I just said and you think that makes sense, then you're not paying attention. They don't care about whether or not it can conflict with things you currently have. The FDA documentation says it right now. I've shown it 45 times on this show. This medicine may interact with any of the following medications: amphetamines like amphetamine. Interesting. Amphetamine. That's weird. Why would it say amphetamines like amphetamine? Dextroamphetamine, I guess there's just different types of amphetamines. The point is, though, is it not possible that somebody somewhere could be on something like this? Lithium, for instance? Kids get that all the time. Maybe not 5 to 11 as commonly as teenagers, but definitely happens. I mean, I've pointed to this before on many occasions, how many children in this country, alarming amounts, are on things like antipsychotics. It's alarming. Millions of children from age 0 to 5 are taking things like antidepressants. I'm not making this up. I've shown this before as well. I'm trying to deviate in all these other points, which I always do. That is incredible. So the point being, all these things could potentially interact. They don't seem to care. What should I watch for while using this medicine? Check this out. Your condition will be monitored carefully while you're receiving this medicine. Oh, really? I'm sure. So either that means that they're decidedly monitoring every 5 to 11 year old is taking this, which is probably happening anyway, or they just don't care about the actual. So when you're taking this in a real world context outside of the secret inclusion in your injection, thromethamine, you'll be monitored carefully, but not this time. We're going to just frivolously hand it out to children in Walgreens, and we'll make sure you watch you for 15 minutes. Well, what are the side effects of this thing they're putting inside this injection for children that don't need it? Confusion, dark urine, fast heartbeat, general ill feeling or flu-like symptoms. Uh-oh. So suddenly, you have COVID. Light-colored stools, pain, redness, irritation at the site, right upper belly pain, sweating, usually weak or tired. I mean, this is going to exacerbate all the things that are already happening, apparently. Dizziness, feeling anxious, increased hunger, loss of appetite, nausea. This has changed. And they're not doing anything about it. Realize as we get into the next part why this is so insulting, because the FDA just put this forward. They don't, apparently, the very group that's supposed to make, like, hey, wait a minute, aren't you supposed to be testing for safety the new additions of chemicals that we already know can cause problems? Yeah, not in the FDA today. The FDA today votes unanimously to push forward something that's unnecessary for your safety. Right? Here's something that causes lots of dangerous situations for your safety. That makes sense. Well, going into the FDA discussion, part of this, something that was shared, I believe, by Robert Malone, buried 6 hours into FDA video, doctor makes chilling admission on child COVID facts. Now, we'll start with this and give you a couple more points in regard to the FDA panel, but this is actually pretty interesting. Now, I want to read you some of the parts of this article first before we get into what he actually says. And I believe they quote it in this article. It says the committee voted 17-0, which I still can't even understand, with one abstention. How can you vote 17-0 to suggest something? I mean, all the data we've shown you is there. They even had the open panel of people that we're going to have you listen to that came on and said, guys, and they listed all of this out. They were forced to see it. The signals, the problems, the myocarditis, the forced removal of things like this. Still get into the point that seems to be this breaking news story that I don't know why is news to anybody. Of course, half the pay, if not all of them, have ties to Pfizer. You know where you've heard this before? Like a zillion times on this show. I just find this hilarious that it's like breaking story coverage of the Pfizer panel. It's like, come on, guys. This is status quo today. It's like, I think what's happening is a lot of these people in the kind of quasi-independent that are kind of capitalizing on ignorance are using points like this to reach the normies to be like, well, breaking story, you know, it's good. Get it in front of them. But let's be real about this. This has been very public information for a long time. They come on, you know, and I'll make some points about when they discuss this and why they come on and say, you know, no conflicts of interest, even though all of them do. The final decision will be made by the FDA leaders, which they did today. Authorizes, and we'll go over what they say here, but that's going to, it swings back to Walensky after this, I believe. Well, it says the one abstention came from Dr. Michael Carrilla, who said he, quote, would have preferred a more nuanced approach and not a blanket authorization for the age group, and then abstained instead of voting no. You see the political pressure here? If he'd have voted no, he probably would have got fired. And it's not even hyperbolic. Like, we've watched how they've removed and changed this to fit their needs, guys. This has been, I mean, look at what's happening in the world in regard to nurses and doctors and everything. Oh, you want an exemption? Well, you're fired for a different reason. Bro, yeah, that's been happening everywhere. We just talked to somebody today about that. We'll have you putting that interview up tomorrow. A more nuanced approach. So he's basically telling you that they just blanket authorizes for people that shouldn't have been blanket authorized. Then it goes on to say another committee member, Dr. Cody Mesner, a pediatrician at Tufts Medical School Center, did voice his concerns over the possibility of vaccine mandates for children. Right, which, by the way, is literally already happening. Quote, I am just worried that if we say yes, which he did right after this, then the states are going to mandate administration of this vaccine for children to go to school. And I do not agree with that. I think that would be an error at this time, he said. Well, wherever that is, hold on. The CDC hasn't decided the vaccine should be limited to certain groups of children, yet Newsom already mandated it for children. He did this before this ever happened. This is the opposite of following the science. This is politics. We've already seen Biden do this. They already get things moving. And we're supposed to pretend like that political pressure is not obviously over the head of the people involved in this thing. I mean, this is why the FDA people, the CDC people rotate through political positions. They know what's on the line when they're in these positions. They won't get what they're supposed to get, the carrot dangled in front of them, if they go against the narrative. If you think that's not how this goes, you're not paying attention. These are captured agencies. It couldn't be more clear today. But so they're already doing this. And he knew this was going to happen. He voted yes anyway. At least he expressed his concern. But it shows you that they're more afraid of being attacked. Quote, it just seems to me that in some ways we're vaccinating children to protect the adults when it should be the other way around. I'll play this for you. This is what one of the doctors said. Dr. James Hildreth, I believe. If 30 million children already have some form of immunity, which they're not talking about, they've made their contribution to herd immunity already, and our focus should be to get adults vaccinated to protect the children. They're not doing that. They're basically using children to protect the adults. How did we ever get in this position where we pretend that's normal? They're not admitting that, but that's what's happening. They're not at risk. They're not spreading it. So you're giving it to them to act like they're protecting you from a very, very slim chance of them doing something that the science has already proven they're not doing, and giving them lots of risk, which we'll sadly go through as we go through the show today. Quote, it's not a lot to go on, but what we do have to go on looks great. Well, that's a resound. I feel great about this. Well, you don't have a lot to go on to inject these little children with things we haven't really proven are safe, but it looks kind of good what we have in front of us. So let's just start it and see what happens. Well, that's the point of one of these next arguments, that they're one of the things they did say in here. I guess we'll show it to you in the clips. I think I skipped it in here because I was going to play it. Anyway, the point is that what they say, one of these people literally says, well, we won't really know until we start using it. Now, the final step is it says, Walensky to sign off, which, if you know, Walensky might as well be a synonymous as rubber stamp. It's what she does. And she just blindly reads the teleprompter when it seems like she, I mean, this person has been put there because she's like that, in my opinion. But jumping over to the actual panel, listening to a couple of these things, let's take a look or listen and look to some of the things that were said that I think are really important. Only a few of them. This won't take as long as we have in the past on the last rubber stamp FDA panel. So let me grab the timestamps here. We're looking at 6:52:21. Also, these things just buried in a 8-hour thing. You know, there's a reason for that. Okay, so 6:51. 52:21. We'll play it from there.
It's a very sort of personal choice. If I had a child who was a transplant recipient, I would really want to be able to use a vaccine like this. And there are certainly kids who probably should be vaccinated. The question of how broadly to use it, though, I think is a substantial one. And I know it's not our question, but I know we're kind of punting that to ACIP. But I do think that it's a relatively close call. And as Dr. Levy just said, as Dr. Gann said, it really is going to be a question of what the prevailing conditions are. But we're never going to learn about how safe the vaccine is unless we start giving it. That's just the...
Well, that's great. And then he nods in approval. Right, cool. So we're never going to really know how safe it is until we start using it. But it's safe and effective, and we're going to force it on children to go to school. But let's just keep trying until we figure out how safe it is. That is literally what he just said. Okay, so let's jump back here for a minute and point out what some people commented on about that. So as Dr. Doug Corrigan, PhD, points out, wait, so we can't use ivermectin because we don't have enough data, but let's vaccinate children to see how safe the vaccine is because we don't have enough data. Right. This is the pinnacle clown world we've found ourselves in. It's subjective. It's about what they want and what their agenda is driving. So if you don't have enough data on both sides, why would you use the one that might hurt? Use the thing that has been tested on humans for a long... I mean, like, I'm not even arguing. You guys should be able to do whatever you want. That's the point. This person says you don't. Ivermectin hasn't been proven to be effective in prevention. Vaccines have. Try to keep up. Oh, of course. Well, that's where I step in and go, keep blindly repeating mainstream media because that's research. Do try to keep up indeed. Here's a study saying an award-winning drug it says expected antiviral properties, right. Oh, and here's another one. Ivermectin, a systematic review from antiviral effects to COVID-19 results. And of course, I go on to say after that, oh, maybe I didn't do it in this one. Follow up with crickets, right? Because they don't, no comment, right? Where are you? Oh, my bad, guys. I was wrong, doctor. I thought I was smarter than you. You're wrong, though. You see, they don't know this stuff. And that's the important part about this. This person, whether a bot or not, if you just take it as an average person, because they do exist out there, who believe that that's the right thing to say. It hasn't been proven. Keep up. Well, yeah, there's been a lot of peer-reviewed studies that have come out that have shown you that this has amazing effects specifically for COVID-19. In fact, it's got far more data than what they're floating for 5 to 11-year-olds right now. But the crazy part about it is that person doesn't know that or doesn't care to. It's crazy. Oh, that's right. We were on the video, so let me go back to that.
The way it goes.
Now, going to the next part. Now, this is where we get into some interesting discussions of the... Oh, actually, no, this is before the open panel. This is one of the other doctors that were on this. And listen to what he has to say. This is 6:53:57. Right here. Perfect.
Immunity already. And our focus should be to get the adults vaccinated to protect the children. So this is a really tough one for me, but I do believe that children at highest risk do need to be vaccinated, but vaccinating all of the children to achieve that just seems a bit much for me. So I'm having some challenges with this one. But those are my thoughts, Dr. Martel. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. I was disappointed that the number of minorities in the Pfizer study, but such a small percentage of the total because they bear the brunt of disease and hospitalizations. And it just seems to me that in some ways we're vaccinating children to protect the adults.
Sorry, I was muted. This is there are some honest people out there, right? I mean, this is interesting. He's just going, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but in this one point, he's saying we are vaccinating children to protect adults. Exactly what we've been saying. It just can't be any more obvious than that. You know what I mean? And this is alarming to you, or this should be alarming to you, that they're telling you exactly what they pretend they're not doing, putting children at risk in order to protect cowardly adults.
And it should be the other way around, that if 30 million children already have some form of immunity, they made their contribution to herd immunity already.
Exactly.
And our focus should be to get the adults vaccinated.
Which I disagree with, obviously. My point is just simply that one plucked out point is very obvious, and they keep hiding this from you. Okay, going to the last point here, and this is one of the most important ones. Steve Kirsch, executive director of the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund, which he's the one that really opened up some of the truth out there on the last one, too. But all the stuff he lists off, and guys, I mean, he's from the early COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund, but the point is that he's laying out data that you can verify for yourself. And they listened, ignored it, and unanimously voted other than one abstention. 440-05. Start right there. We'll catch the tail end of this guy's, which he does say something. There, you know, a lot of these people are speaking out, at least to some degree, about what's going on.
No one benefits if we judge and ridicule each other. Slide 10. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity to present to you.
Thank you, Dr. Berger. The next speaker is Steve Kirsch.
Hi, I'm Steve Kirsch, executive director of the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund. I have no conflicts of interest. Slide 2. Why are kids dropping like flies right after getting vaccinated? If they didn't die from the vaccine, then what killed these kids? Next slide. How can a healthy 16-year-old boy die in the middle of a Zoom math class? He was fine 20 minutes before he died. Next slide. The doctors found nothing. What did the CDC find? Next slide.
That's an important point to think about, right? This is what I keep talking about with theirs and everything else. The doctors who looked at these people, the Zoom kids specifically, there's no logical reason. And that is what the guy from Pittsburgh, one of the lead medical examiners, said on the record. When we do not have a plausible reason why this is happening, that's typically an indication it's the vaccine. But nobody else is willing to admit that. You just go, oh, well, it must have been magic then, and it definitely wasn't the vaccine. That's where we end up, and that's what happens here. The doctor said, we don't know. The CDC somehow says it wasn't the vaccine, but yet doesn't give you an other reason. What was the cause then? That's very self-serving. This is criminal, guys.
Why did this 15-year-old die in his sleep just 2 days after getting vaccinated? Slide number 6. How did you miss all of these safety signals?
Exactly.
Slide number 7. If the vaccines are so safe, how come Taiwan officially admits that the vaccines kill more people than the virus? Slide 8.
This is the absurd point of pretending that, you know, entire governments are anti-science fringe conspiracy theorists, which is certainly possible. It's just so funny how, you know, we have governments like Sweden or, you know, countries that are even like ostensibly on the side of the U.S. government agenda that are sent, you know, take another stance and then they just stop talking about them. How do you ignore something like that? Right? It's all over the place. There's huge entire health agencies that are standing up and saying, well, this test isn't even accurate for this situation. Well, we'll stop talking about them then. they're obviously based on their scientific research. That's why they just ignore it going forward, because you can't call everybody anti-science fringe conspiracy theorists, even though they're trying to.
Find this recent UK headline troubling? Slide 9.
And I'll read this for the podcast. And he basically said, don't you find this headline troubling? And it says, children are up to 16 times more likely to die with COVID-19 if they've had a COVID vaccine, according to the latest UK Health Security Agency report. Right. We've covered most of everything he's listing off here, guys.
How are Germany and Norway both able to determine causality in sample sizes of 100 or less, but the CDC can't determine causality in over 16,000 deaths it hasn't investigated? Slide 10.
Exactly. because they're choosing not to. That's the only logical understanding here, guys, because as long as it's unverified, they can keep dismissing it.
How come deaths in Israel go up when vaccinations go up and go down when vaccinations go down?
Look at that. Look at that graph, guys. For the podcast, it's exactly what he said. It's almost, I mean, there's variations, but and correlation is not causation. But the fact that nobody's willing to consider that shows you that there's an obvious taboo discussion. You can't consider that, otherwise you'll be kicked out of the room. Every time injections go up, the deaths go up. It's as simple as that.
Slide 11. What is the VAERS underreporting factor? How can you do a risk benefit analysis if you don't know the URF? This is extremely, extremely important. You've been assuming it's been one. It is not one. Slide 12. Using a URF of 41, which is calculated using the CC methodology, we find over 300,000 excess deaths in VAERS. If the vaccine didn't kill these people, then what did? Slide number 13.
Now, this is basically you could utilize a lot of different factors from different places in the world. Specifically here, there's, I think, at least a couple of different estimates. The one we always point to is the main one by the Health and Human Services and Harvard that came to their conclusion that this represents less than 1% of the total. That wasn't during COVID. That was long before this. It's a general estimate about what gets reported. And especially today, you could probably argue that that number is way less because of how much negative attention is around any report or any argument that's negative against the injection. So you can almost guarantee that number is way less than that. But even less than 1%, it's times it by 100, guys. It is outrageous that we are not even considering this. Again, this is the safety signals that have always been there, that they've always pretended to use at the very least, that now are just something different. The system is the same.
Is there any stopping condition to these experiments? How many Americans have to die before you pull the plug? How many kids have to die before you yell stop? Slide 14. Why are there no autopsies for deaths after vaccination?
Exactly.
Slide 15. Why?
Now ask yourself that, right? How in the world can they possibly know that these things weren't caused by injection if they didn't even do autopsies? Remember, they're the ones arguing we've investigated all of them and none of them are deaths. None of them are because of the vaccine. You heard Peter McCullough say it in the beginning. How is that possible if they haven't done the autopsies? They're lying to you. It's as simple as that. Even after an autopsy, as I just referenced, the lead medical examiner said, it's almost impossible to find out what caused it. But when there's no clear cause and you see an obvious riddled blood clot brain, well, then you go, it probably was the injection. What was the underlying caveat? What was the factor, right? What was the new introduction in the situation here of the injection? They're not doing autopsies. They don't know, and they don't care to know.
Why didn't the highly unusual cause of death in these kids raise any red flags in the CDC 12 to 17 safety study?
That's an important one right there. He's showing the slut from the 12 to 17-year-old study, right? Remember, we're talking one in a million chance for 19-year-olds with no comorbidities, according to Oxford. In the 12 to 17 year olds, they found things that you can see for the podcast: pulmonary embolism, intracranial hemorrhage. This happened in their trial for children. And of course, his question is, why didn't we care about that? Doesn't matter though, because we didn't talk about it.
They didn't even comment. They said, just move on. Nothing to see here. Slide 16. How many months do troponin levels stay elevated after vaccination? Slide 17. Of the over nearly 140,000 comments have been posted against the vaccines in kids, I found only one comment in favor. How many did you find? Slide 18. Did you ever read the Kostov paper? It says that five times as likely to die from the vaccine as from COVID. And it's even worse if you're younger.
Yep. You guys have seen this. We've been over this extensively on the show. Why are we vaccinating children against COVID-19? Elsevier, right? These are highly regarded scientific publications, and this is, it's like he said, five times as likely to die. They're ignoring all of this. And what I want you to realize is the FDA panel is sitting here listening to this. They're seeing this. They don't care.
Slide 19. Why was this paper removed over the objections of the editors? Slide 19.
That's even crazier. Like, this one's really interesting. This is one that Robert Malone commented on, said never in his history of his entire scientific career to the objection of the editor. The point is that the scientists were not even notified. I've said this many times. The point of peer review is that, I mean, they're reviewing to make sure that they feel that it is sound. It's peer reviewed. It's then published. Then when they circle back and remove things, that's not how this is supposed to go. So what's happening is politics. It's unreal, especially when you can say, when the editors make a political choice and don't even tell the scientists. And that was the study for the podcast about myocarditis in the U.S. adverse events, the VAERS discussion. They don't care about any of this.
Found 19, or slide 20, they took 19 times the expected number of myocarditis cases and a fivefold increase on dose two. Slide 22. Jeez. Is this what you mean by slightly elevated risk?
Look at that graph, guys. This is rare. We just read it. They said rare. It's a rare thing. Apparently not.
And let's skip to slide 26. How can a kid who was in the Pfizer 12 to 15-year-old trial be paralyzed and not have that reported to the FDA? How can you approve a vaccine for under 12 when you haven't investigated this study? Let's skip to the end here, slide number 30, which is the complete list of my questions are posted on Trial Site News today. Just search for Virbac. There are too many unanswered questions for you to approve the vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds. Thank you.
Completely agree. We'll talk about Maddie in a second. Unreal. Now there's more on there as always, but it's a lot to watch. It's unnerving, isn't it? Buried in the videos. Well, what are the main points that we're never going to know for sure until we just start using it. That's fantastic. One of the persons says, well, we're using kids to protect adults and that's not how it should work. I mean, all this stuff, all that data, and they still 17 to zero. Right here. Breaking. Now that was, first of all, the panel suggesting that it should be used. And now here we have the FDA today authorizes the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use in children ages to 5 to 11. Emergency use. Because clearly we're still in an emergency, right? Even though we never were, based on any metric from before this. And that's you can look that up. It's easy. You can just get to this running accumulation of deaths that keep adding to a total, which we know is not accurate, and just be like, we've had over a million for how long now? We've been tallying this slowly, right? We're not in any semblance of an emergency right now. We're just not. They keep hyping it up because that's what keeps people fearful. But on top of that, those age groups are simply not in danger. And on top of that, there's other useful treatments. And on top of that, there's an approved substance. I mean, you take your pick. Any one of these things should remove the idea of an emergency authorization. I've read that to you many times. But here's their key points. Effectiveness. Immune responses of children 5 to 11 years of age were comparable to those of individuals 16 through 25. In that study, the vaccine was 90.7. So understand what they're saying. The immune responses were comparable to those of 16 to 25. Now, it seems like they're saying in that study of 16 to 25, the vaccine was 90.7. But I guess we don't know because that's how they play their words with their language. And we just have to assume, are they talking about that study? Or maybe they're comparing them. It doesn't matter. Either way, that 90.7 is a manipulation, as you all know by now, because it's not actually talking about the kind of threat that they're claiming it is. I think I still have this here. I was going to try to grab that video and play for you the absolute risk clip that I played just yesterday. Maybe not. I should have grabbed it beforehand. Here it is.
You have the right to know the potential benefit of any intervention. For example, Pfizer reported that its vaccine shows a 95% efficacy. That sounds like it protects you 95% of the time, right? But that's not actually what that number means. That 95% refers to the relative risk reduction, but it doesn't tell you how much your overall risk is reduced by vaccination. For that, we need absolute risk reduction. In the Pfizer trial, 8 out of 18,198 people who were given the vaccine developed COVID-19. In the unvaccinated placebo group, 162 people got it, which means that even without the vaccine, the risk of contracting COVID-19 was extremely low at 0.88%, which the vaccine then reduced to 0.04%. So the net benefit, or the absolute risk reduction that you're being offered with a Pfizer vaccine, is 0.84%.
Okay. That's reality for you. Now, remember that Dr. Fauci, I mean, there's no way around it, lied to you about conflating and using relative risk reduction when he discussed the original. And that's just kind of maintained ever since. This is an illusion. If you have a 0.84% reduction in risk, that needs to be explained to people. to say 99% effective, people think it's 99% effective at keeping them safe. It is not. That's what you're looking at. And this is right inside their documentation. And this is what's crazy is, as we always say, we're the ones being censored. This is very easy to look up. So the bottom line is, if all you get is that much of an increase in risk reduction, it's not really working in any sense of the word. Because people are still catching it, spreading it, and getting sick and dying and hospitalized. And we're showing you that a million times over, and we'll show it again today. When I say people, I mean vaccinated people in all walks of life, because that still continues. But the point is, they're telling you it's not, and it's all the unvaxxed, when in reality, the data shows the opposite, and this is likely why. Because this is not much of a reduction. These are people who have injections, meaning they have reduced their antibodies according to all the data we've shown you. On the other side of it, you got a lot of people who have natural immunity. Gee, I wonder why one side is struggling.
That 95% number, that refers to the relative difference between 0.88 and 0.04%. That's what they call 95% relative risk reduction. And relative risk reduction is well known to be a misleading number, which is shocking. Why the FDA recommends using absolute risk reduction instead, which begs...
So why haven't they raised that since this, during this period? Oh, well, they're using the wrong one. They're trying to trick you. Probably because they don't care.
The question, how many people would have chosen to take the COVID-19 vaccines had they understood that they offered less than 1% benefit?
Right. Probably a lot less. Well, they just happily keep shoving that number in your face because that's what makes it look okay. Then it says under safety, the vaccine safety was studied in approximately 3,000 children. Wow, that's crazy. Super small and super long. Or super large and super small. No, this is short and a small study on one of the most, the children that don't need it. This is what you're basing it on. And guess what? It says no serious side effects have been detected in the ongoing study. Oh, cool. So we're already giving it to children, but it's still ongoing safety trials, just like before. But all they realize that no serious side effects. That's not even true. Also, ask yourself if this is just another sidestep. Maybe they've redefined what serious means. This is how manipulative all of this has become. But that's not even accurate. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will meet next week to discuss further clinical recommendations. I wonder what's going to happen. There's that video for you to include. Now, just to revisit this again, I'm not going to dive deep into this because I genuinely don't think, half dozen of the FDA vaccine panel members who just voted for that are tied to Pfizer. Yes, that's incredibly relevant. I just don't know why this is new information. We've been talking about this from the very beginning. These people are compromised. They are absolutely sitting in a position. This is the definition of conflict of interest. And their argument, as we've gone over in an entire show, is they argue, well, there's just not enough good people out there for these positions, so we have to consider people that are conflict. That's not true either. There's been entire studies that have proven there's a wealth of people out there in the world and the United States that are well-credentialed, and they pick people that are compromised. Why? I think you know why. Read this for yourself if you want to dive in. The reality is there's a lot of different ways they're compromised, whether from having previous positions, having financial ties, from being paid to do studies. These people are compromised by Pfizer and plenty of others, by the way. It just so happens they're voting on Pfizer specifically in this case, but these people are compromised all over the place because it's a captured agency. That's the bottom line. Now, according to... AAP Solim, what is this? Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, I'm assuming, based on the name right there. Latest numbers on pediatric COVID mortality by state. Several states still report zero cumulative pediatric deaths from COVID. Here it is. Now, just to make a point, by the way, there's a reason that I didn't even care to look into, people that will first go look at who's sharing something and then use that to either accept or dismiss something are acting like children. You're being led into a subjective way of living because of the media. It works for the media's manipulations. It matters who shares something. Of course it does. But if there's a source link and it's data, who cares if you can lean into the research and find out for yourself? Just a point that I always try to make. Not to say anything one way or the other about this group. I'm not even familiar with them. But the point is, here's the link. So let's look for ourselves. So here's the two bottom ones I find most important. Child hospitalization data and child death, child mortality. Now look at these. Look at the information. Do you realize this is all? This is the total information. APEX child hospitalization data available on this date. So in total, all data reported are preliminary, subject to change. Of course, they are. Now, look at the numbers. It's by state, right? 56 in Alaska. All said and done. Just look at the hospitalization rate, guys. You can't just highlight that side. But look, 0.2, 1.4, 1.0. These are not alarming. Now, Arizona seems to have a high number, but in regard to the entire process, compare that to just normal hospitalizations of children over the entire span of this process. It's not concerning. I mean, anything is to a degree concerning. Nobody should be hospitalized or have to die, but those things happen. The point is that is this, in the proper context, more alarming than normal situations? It doesn't appear so to me. You can look through this for yourself. Cumulative child hospitalizations. I mean, some of these places have 34, 56. I mean, so we're concerned about that. I mean, whatever your argument is, this does not make sense in the context of an emergency, especially to inject them with something that increases their risk of something that could increase their mortality by up to 50%. And it exponentially increases that risk, as they just told you, up by, what did it say, 9 times? Now, going down to the death, which I think is the most important part, because that's the end game, right? That's old. Now, yes, hospitalizations and long this and long that could be something, but we're not there, and we don't know for sure, so we can't point to a hypothetical future. But the point is that not dying is the ultimate end goal that we all are honestly pointing at. You look at the numbers. Some of these places have zero. Zero. Washington, D.C., Idaho, zero. Yet nonetheless, they are going to force this. They are going to use this. They're going to, at the very least, offer this to children 5 to 11, and their parents will get it because they want to travel and they want to go to the beach and whatever, because they've been convinced that it's safe and effective. Why would you do that if you have zero deaths? Or even at the most we're looking at, I think the most I saw in here was 99 in Texas. Over this entire process, and realize, even going back to the hospitalizations, taking one of the big ones, saying Georgia, for instance, 2000. Remember that this story was broke by Newsweek. They exposed the whole way that they were manipulating this in all regards, but children specifically. I think it was up to 40, and it was almost 50% of all of the child hospitalizations they could find were not actually around COVID. People went in with a broken leg and got a test and were told they had COVID, and then they left. And they go down as a COVID hospitalization. But was it a COVID hospitalization? No. They went in for a different reason. They left when they got better. It had nothing to do with COVID. That is what a false positive looks like, but they still go down as a COVID-19 hospitalization. How do we have even the mainstream exposing these manipulations, and yet they're still driving this forward? Go through this data for yourself. This is not indicative of any kind of an emergency, let alone for the children who are at least risk of even getting sick or dying from this. Now, here is an article from Aaron Seary. FDA buries data on seriously injured child in Pfizer's COVID-19 clinical trial. Now, this is MATA. You've seen this before. We've talked about this. We actually covered this right when it happened. Now, it says the FDA should not authorize the jab for young children until it conducts a proper trial. When Stephanie and Patrick DeGuerre enrolled their 12-year-old child, Maddie, and her two brothers in Pfizer's COVID-19 trial, they believed they were doing the right thing. So remember, this is a person who was in the trial, not just real world. So it's very clear. They were monitoring everything. That's why this is so unnerving. That decision has turned into a nightmare. Maddie, a previously healthy, energetic, full of life child, was within 24 hours of her second dose reduced to a crippling, scream-inducing pain that landed her in the emergency room, where she described feeling like someone was, quote, ripping her heart through her neck. That should really sink in. Over the next several months, the nightmare continued, during which Maddie was hospitalized several times and suffered numerous systemic injuries, requiring a tube through her nose that carries her food and medicine and a wheelchair for assistance that, as far as I understand it, is still happening. At the very least, it was still happening months afterward when she went to discuss this in front of people who they thought would actually do something about it, government, and then did nothing about it. So Mrs. DeGuerre documented every detail of Maddie's injury and reported to the principal investigator for the Pfizer trial. So this is where they had their ear because they were in the trial, right? This is at Cincinnati's Children's Hospital where the vaccine clinical trial was occurring and where Maddie was treated and admitted. So she like it was right there. They're in the hospital where the trial was happening. So there's no way they can't see this for what it is. They first tried to treat Maddie as a mental patient. Do you understand how crazy that is? You're in a trial where you're giving an experimental injection that's not approved. Then she, within 24 hours, has this crippling debilitation, which she's, and she, before that, was perfectly healthy. And they submit her to the same hospital as a mental patient. How do you even justify something so obviously ridiculous? At the very least, they bring her in and go, well, let's find out first. No, they submit her as a mental patient because that's what they wanted to do. That shows you there, that points to an inherent level of malicious dishonesty within this entire thing. Telling the family while they watched what happened that it was all psychological and in Maddie's imagination. That's not a joke, and this is documented this is in documentation for their lawsuit. Or was it a lawsuit or for their engagement for trying to get paid like money for what happened through the trip for the vaccine court, which probably won't happen. Regardless, it's been documented. So she's in a wheelchair, having her food sent as through a tube, and it's her imagination? That's not a joke. That's what they said. They then claimed it was unrelated to the vaccine. Copy of recording with the hospital below. This, you can listen to it. And when that argument failed, Pfizer listed this traumatic adverse event. So understand, so they tried to say, no, you're crazy. And then they were forced to list it as a traumatic adverse event because they were proven to be. And guess what they deceptively put down on the documentation? Functional abdominal pain. Not just abdominal pain, but functional. So it's not bad. Okay, but how about it wasn't even remotely abdominal pain? This was a crippling debilitation that changed her life forever, and she's in a wheelchair. And that is what they write down after seeing it all take place and being forced to admit it was actually linked to the injection. Mrs. DeGuerre reported what occurred to the CDC and FDA through VAERS, because that's what they're told to do, in June 2021, but nobody from these agencies sought additional information or followed up with the DeGuerres. Yeah, because they're checking all of them and none of them are linked to it, right? Ms. DeGuerre also reached out to Dr. Nath, a chief in the NIH's National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, responded by stating he was, quote, sorry to hear of your daughter's illness, and that, quote, we have certainly heard of a lot of cases of neurological complications from the vaccine and will be glad to share our experience with them. How can that be stated on a recorded call from the NIH chief of National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke? And yet today, she's still being told she's crazy. People are still being dismissed. Yes, he says again, we have certainly heard a lot of cases of neurological complications from the vaccine. And then goes silent after they realize they're not supposed to talk about it. Unfortunately, other than a call arranged by Maddie's neurologist, there was no follow-up response from the NIH or any other federal agency. Even after Ms. DeGuerre did a press event on June 28, 2021 with Senator Ron Johnson, neither Pfizer nor any health agency reached out to her in any manner to address Maddie's injuries or obtain any additional information. This should drive you crazy because this is what they're hiding. How can you pretend that is in her brain, in her mind, that she's crazy? Then even after they admit and write down that it wasn't. It's horrifying. And as James Lyons-Weiler points out, if the U.S. FDA is going to ignore the pleas of a 12-year-old girl injured by Pfizer's injection, even during their own trial, and fail to follow up on evidence that Pfizer fraudulently coded her paralysis as a stomach ache, any police action by FDA anywhere in the U.S. is illegitimate. This is an example of their criminal activity. It's as simple as that, criminal activity. And the reality is what he's saying here, that they have this information, the pleas of a 12-year-old girl in their trial, and then covered that up. So think about the relevance of when they're over here saying, oh, but there were no serious events in the detection in the trial with 5 to 11-year-olds. Yeah, I bet you they kicked out all the ones that started to show problems and covered up the rest, seeing as how we watched this happen. My opinion, though. But don't worry, though, guys, because Twitter's medical update with no source material, just regurgitation of what CNN says Pfizer said, because that's great journalism. Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine is safe and effective for elementary school children, according to the FDA. Oh, good times. But that's it. No data needed, because you don't need data to research. You just need to trust what authority says. And Twitter's making themselves an authority. Safe and effective for elementary school kids that don't need it, that aren't at risk, and it's not safe and it's not effective. But who cares about any of that stuff? Oh, and don't worry, because they're already talking about 2 to 4-year-olds, because that's the next step.
Let me push it back even further. What about 2 to 4-year-olds? Are there data being gathered on that? Do you expect at some point we will be able to inoculate even children as young as 2?
Why? There's no logical reason. There is literally no scientific reason to inject these kids.
I do expect to do that. Of course, the studies need to be completed. I'm optimistic because I have seen these results between 5 and 11.
Also, take note of what it says on the screen. The Pfizer CEO says that it's safe to mix and match your injections, even though it still says on the CDC page and the FDA page that we have no data to recommend that it's safe. And in fact, the CDC page that it says it should not be done. How do you even explain that, as both of those groups are saying, go ahead and do it? I'll leave that to you. Are they trying to hurt you? Do they not care? I mean, the data is there for you to look at.
For the 2 to 5 years old, the studies are ongoing right now. I think should be completed by the end of the year.
Already happening.
And another formulation is using a very small fraction of the mRNA that we are using with adults. It's 2 micrograms. Compared to 30 micrograms that a normal dose compares, or 100 that the Moderna's dose contains. So these 2 micrograms, I think we expect to be very, very safe and give good immune responses. So also those kids will be protected.
God, I mean, this is just, it just feels so wrong to me. You know, like, I mean, it's obviously wrong, but I mean, like, in a sinister sort of way, right? Why would they even argue? I mean, you could maybe say from his perspective, they just make money. It's a business. That's what they're always about. But I don't agree with that. I think there's a lot more going on here. But from a government perspective, from a regulatory perspective, how do they pretend that this even makes sense? That's what I'm really baffled about. Like, there's no logical argument here. Are you really suggesting that we're going to get them injected to protect the adults? Because that's the only logical play out here. If they're spreading it, but they're not in danger, they just keep going, well, they might get sick in long haul, and we don't know. So we're going to give them something that increases their risk of myocarditis exponentially. And they keep pointing to, but COVID causes it even more. Yeah, but the risk of catching COVID is way lower than the risk of getting it after the injection. So stop saying such a stupid argument. They just don't care. Next 2 to 4-year-olds, next 0 to 6, 0 to 1, 6 months to whatever. This is going to continue. This is going to be added to the juvenile vaccination list. And I can promise you that. That's the plan. Despite the fact that, as we just showed you, vaccination rates are not even linked to lower COVID rates. But who cares about all the facts, though? We'll just keep saying it works and it's safe and effective and repeat the mantras. This is the data. The scientific research is showing you, this is from the European Journal of Epidemiology, from 168 countries and almost 3,000 U.S. counties, they found that vaccination rates that were higher were not associated with COVID-19 cases. Here's the study itself. We just talked about this. The lack of meaningful association between percentage population of fully vaccinated and new COVID cases is further exemplified, for instance, by comparison of the places like Iceland and Portugal, who both have over 75% population fully vaccinated, yet have more cases than countries like South Africa and Vietnam, who have below 10%. At a country level, there appears to be no discernible relationship between percentage of vaccination and cases of COVID-19. I don't know how you can misunderstand this. Across the U.S. counties, now the main point here, there also appears to be no significant signaling of COVID-19 case decreasing with higher percentage of vaccination. And they also argue that almost a slight positive benefit, positive association without less vaccination. But the main point is the high transmission counties. The places with the highest amount of injections are the highest, are some of the most high transmission areas. And those with the lowest are adversely the other way. 57 counties that have been classified as low transmission are some of the lowest vaccination rates. There's no way to misunderstand this. But they're just going to inject kids anyway, right? Because who cares? But here's another point that we added. I'm just going to run through this quick so you can see this stuff. This is the UK study. Just so you can see the main page. Week 42, showing you that the recent observations from the UK, the new UK Security Agency of Health surveillance data, they're showing you that your neutralizing antibody levels appear lower in individuals who acquire infection after two doses. So how does that even make sense? Because as Bauer's trying to cover up for now, it reduces your antibodies. And that's pretty damn obvious. And that's what the studies and the data and the Red Cross and the mainstream report and all these things have shown you. And even Bauer had said, after two shots, you have 5 to 6 times lower antibodies. That's exactly what the study says that we showed you ourselves. And here, by the way, adding to it, Jerusalem Post, antibody levels decrease after two doses. And it says it happens very fast. Decreases rapidly after two doses. But yeah, let's keep giving it to kids, even though we're increasing their risk with not a lot of help in general. But there was one other point that, I believe it was over here. We'll get to that in a second. Okay, so on top of that, we're seeing new study today, which is the latter part of the show, that is telling you that you are just as likely to spread this thing. At the very least, you have the same amount of infectious viral load as somebody who is not injected. And now remember, watch, this is actually really hilarious almost how silly this is. Wait, remember when it was safe and effective, almost 100%, and that it's totally protecting you against transmission. They kept saying that and then slowly and kept going, no, it doesn't. No, and then we were censored. And then finally they had to admit it, but they only admitted it once Delta came around, even though it was never happening, right? And they kind of grudgingly admitted that after the fact. It's not stopping transmission. You can still catch it. You can still spread it. But it shifted where suddenly it was like, well, yes, you can get it, but it's super rare hospitalization and death. Well, that's clearly not happening either. But now we've gotten to the point, as it says here, you are as infectious if you are double jabbed as you are not if you are zero jabbed. The BBC reports this with a straight face. Countries with the highest vaccination rate have the highest number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths from COVID. That's what the data shows you guys, and they're just desperate to hide this. Take a listen.
So you suggest there's strong evidence that some people who've been double jabbed catching COVID and passing it on to those they live with. I hope that it's a human is with me. What exactly does the study show?
Well, Clive, this research and a publication in Lancet Infectious Diseases reminds us that household transmission of the virus is a noteworthy source of spread of COVID, and that if you've had your two doses, your risk of getting the virus is reduced, but you can still get it. And it concludes that you are as infectious in that situation as someone who hasn't had the jabs.
Okay, so that's not can be, that is. And what he just said there, sorry, that was probably kind of low, is that the shifting of the narrative, right? So he's saying right here.
The source of spread of COVID, two doses, your risk of getting the virus is reduced.
So he's saying once you get two doses, your risk of getting it is reduced, right? It is reduced, but you still can't catch it. Like, they haven't even said it like that. Well, it used to be super, super, super rare. Well, now it's like, well, it's a little bit reduced. Totally still get it, though. And if you do, you're just as sick as everybody else. Okay, wait a minute. Or rather, I should be more specific. He said you just as high a viral load, which I don't know why. I mean, if we're seeing the hospitalizations and deaths just as more so in that regard, well, then obviously that means they're just as sick. And obviously that does then mean, in my opinion, that, well, you could look at it one of two ways. Either it's causing them to get sick, it's not stopping them from getting sick, one of three ways, or it is causing illness that they're being called COVID-19 when it's really just side effects of the injection. Really, what's the difference? It all adds up in the same direction. It's probably all the spike protein anyway. It's all the same thing happening, in my opinion. It all adds up in the same. We just showed you the study from these highly credentialed experts that are finding that you are getting long-haul COVID after the injection. That was literally what they found. People who had never had COVID-19, never gotten and all they got was the injections. And then they're coming down with basically what looks like scientifically COVID-19 and then getting long haul symptoms after it. There's that is about as clear as it gets. Now, as Chuck points out, and I just shared this because here's the Bloomberg article with their big block in front of you, because that's what failing news articles outlets do. Breaking report, vaccinated people are just as likely as unvaccinated people to spread the Delta variant that was the big focus, to contacts in their household. A year-long study found in Bloomberg. Well, here's BBC with their typically manipulative headline to make it not as serious as it is actually. Double vaccinated can still spread at home. Burying the lead as they love to do when it matters. But here's what BBC has to say. According to the study, which ran from September 2020 to September 2021 and included 440 households in London and Bolton doing PCR COVID tests, which, of course, huge caveat, as always, which remember, I mean, since I believe I actually do have that up here somewhere. Yeah, I figured I might grab this and show it. Let me just pull this over real quick. We just talked about this the other day, right? As we're always pointing to the PCR test, let's not forget that when they made the PCR test, or rather when they pushed forward the emergency authorization, and this one was updated effective as of 7/21, don't forget what it said here. Since no quantified virus isolates of the SARS of the SARS-CoV-2 were available for CDC use at the time the test was developed and the study was conducted in 7/21. So they didn't have isolates of what they said they were testing for when they made the test for that testing. That's ridiculous. On top of that, somehow magically, the CDC still doesn't have qualified isolates all the way in July 2021. Yeah, because that makes sense. No, it doesn't. It's not isolated. They never did. And that's the point. And everyone's been trying to yell that at people, and it's been covered up, like the fact that masks aren't working the way that they say they do, the fact that this thing's not effective as they say it is, the fact that the PC, I mean, I could go through 1,000 things that they're hiding from you. But just don't forget that, as they keep pointing to the PCR test. But on that note, it says, according to the study, people who are double jabbed had a lower but still appreciable risk of becoming infected with Delta variant compared with unvaccinated people. It's not just Delta variant. It's pretty much everything we're seeing. They just keep pointing to Delta as the one thing because they try to pretend that only happened because the unvaccinated, even though we're literally every data point around this is proving why it's happening because of the injected. And I've done entire shows about that if you're interested. Appreciable. Like, what is the actual definition of that? It's I love this. Large or important enough to be noticed. That's fantastic. So they just admitted to you that you have a lower but still large risk of becoming infected. That's what they just said there. That's what the word means. That's why they probably used it. A lower but large. So not actually rare or reduced really than normal, but just lower than those unvaxxed people over there. I don't even know if that's true because the data doesn't back that up. But look at what they're admitting to you now. Look at how far that has changed. Are you still going to get your booster tomorrow? How is that going to work out? But it also says they also appear to be just as infectious, right? So if you get sick, you are just as infectious. But don't forget, they're hiding behind the just as infectious, the fact that the data shows you that you have a higher viral load. Higher. All of them have shown you that. Higher. But they see, when they said that before, they tried to pretend like it was only rare, super rare breakthrough cases. Then it's even more. But they're telling you it's not super rare. So don't forget what they said before when they were hiding it behind super rare, that it's higher viral load, 4 to 5 times more, I believe, if I'm remembering that correctly. Then it says vaccinated people clear the infection more quickly, but their peak viral load when people are most infectious is similar to that seen in unvaccinated people. That's such a manipulative way to say that. And why would they clear the infection quicker? That's, I haven't seen that backed up, to be quite honest, but regardless, the point is that this is light years away from what they were trying to tell you was happening in the beginning. They were saying 100% effective transmission. You're safe. Unvaxxed are dangerous. Quite a bit different, isn't it? Well, coming over here to what we just showed, this is the most recent the most recent report they put out in regard to the new health agency. This is week 43. We've already looked at, but let's look at the actual data breakdown again of cases. So this is my point I was making before. Are the cases super rare? Well, no, they say, because most of them are vaccinated. Okay. Well, then it would be hospitalizations and deaths that are super rare. That would be the argument. The cases, of course, but no, they're still, because if all of them are there, regardless of how many people are vaccinated, it still shows you that they're most at risk. Okay, so let's look at first cases. Table 2. This is COVID-19 cases by vaccination status between week 39 and 42, 2021. Remember that they stopped really comparing these going forward, as far as I can tell. But here's what it says. Not vaccinated. Under 18 is the only one that appears to be more. And you could argue that's simply because most people under 18 don't have injections. So most of them will be, which is a fair thing to say. But when you factor in all of it together, is my point. It shows you that what they're saying does not make sense. But here at 18 to 29, almost 30,000 fully injected cases, right? Okay, going forward, 30 to 39, almost 60, over 63,000 cases in fully. We're not even including after one dose. But look at what it is on not vaccinated. 23,000. How do you not see that for what it is? And look at how crazy it gets as you go forward. 40 to 49. When you get into the groups, they tell you are actually the most at risk. The risk increases for the most at risk. That makes sense, doesn't it? 119,000 from 40 to 49 for fully injected. Not vaccinated, only 14,000 cases. 88,000 for 50 to 59 for fully injected. 6,000 for not vaccinated, injected. And so on and so on. Okay, jumping forward to table three. COVID-19 cases presenting to emergency care, so hospitalizations. And this is same week, 39 to 42. Okay, so now arguably the point should be that this should be way lower because the cases, of course, because they're all injected now, even though that's not even accurate, it's like more, a little more than half. So that doesn't even still add up. But taking what they said, let's look at this. Under 18, 592 emergency cases. Now, remember that we're talking about people that are going into emergency rooms and being given a PCR test, and a lot of them aren't even actually there for anything remotely related to COVID-19. That is part of it. But that's, again, the only area, it seems. Or actually, you know, it gets to about 40 to 49 is when it starts to shift. So you can see under 18 to 29, you have 212 emergency care, not vaccinated, 74 fully injected. Or really, you, I always, in my mind, include the one dose too, just because that is absolutely injected. But once you get to 30 to 39, or excuse me, 40 to 49, again, the groups that are at most risk, not injected, 495 emergency care visits, 437 fully injected, plus 40 for one, 50 to 59, 447 not injected, fully injected, 632. Okay, so here you see it tilt the other way. So even if you want to call this half, that still does not add up with super, super rare only cases. You can clearly see as we go forward, this is tapered very aggressively on the side of the injected where it matters most. 60 to 69, 288 not injected hospitalizations. Fully injected, 841. 70 to 79, only 195 not injected. Fully injected, 1,409. This is being hidden from people because if this was really being digested, this would end everything. You're giving people, you're giving your grandmother something under the guise that is protecting her because she's at most risk. Protect your grandma, right? Wear the mask, protect your grandma. And a whole, and the grandmas that are 100 are not injected are dramatically at less risk of hospitalization based on this information. Going to above 80, it goes down 157 for not injected, 1,527 for fully injected. Now let's look at deaths. Same thing. Deaths within 28 days and 60 days of positive test and on and on. Same, all their caveat. 39, week 39 to 42. Same thing. Starting with pretty much right out of the gate. The only category you can see that seems to be less deaths than the injected, which is just crazy to me, is under 18. Because if you only have four, by the way, under 18, it one shows you that they're not even remotely at risk here, guys. And I wonder whether any of those four deaths were actually COVID-19, as we also proved that they didn't even verify the 300 to 400 they keep claiming is happening in the U.S. Bloomberg, I believe, is the one that reported that and said they have yet to even verify a single one of them. But on that note, remember that basically none of them are injected with both the doses. But at the end of the day, going to 18 and 29 ahead and forward. From there forward, it's all the injected. Or 30 to 39, I guess, 7-3. 18 deaths reported in 30 to 39 category who were not injected. Or excuse me, I keep... same thing I'm doing before. So it's 50 to 59, 74, 77. And here's where it gets ridiculous. Now, the factor in the total here, guys. Because if you're looking 4 to 3, 18 to 6, 35 to 28, that's not a lot. But once you get above these ages where they're most at risk, in 60 to 69, you see 105 deaths in not injected and 250 after both doses. 70 to 79, 101 not injected, 612. In double injected. Over 80, you know, the grandmas were trying to protect. Only 143 deaths after who were not injected. 1,209 after both injections. Now, look, if you're trying to pretend that that's all because they were all going to they were all old, they're going to die anyway, it just doesn't make sense with other arguments you made from before this. You can't play it both ways. Bottom line is this is an obvious representation that their argument that it's all just cases and it's all super rare after that is a lie. Period. With all the things we're seeing and everything in front of you, all the information we're showing, that's the reality being that this is hurting you, that it doesn't make a difference. And they're forcing it on children anyway. Which brings me to another concerning report coming out of IPAC. This is a group that you should be paying attention to. It's conducting peer-reviewed research without the manipulative arm of the FDA and the CDC or government agencies in general. Because that's all that peer review is really about. Other doctors and experts reviewing science. Not when you have anybody else involved, that's politics. But it says spontaneous abortions and that's my opinion, by the way. Spontaneous abortions and policies on COVID-19 mRNA vaccine use during pregnancy. Now, I'm just going to read you the abstract. Please go through this entirely, because all they're really calling for is for them to conduct this properly. The use of mRNA vaccines in pregnancy is now generally considered safe for protection against COVID-19 in countries such as New Zealand, USA, and Australia, despite, by the way, their documentation saying they haven't got the data. However, the influential CDC-sponsored article used to support this idea on closer inspection, which you remember because we did that on our show, went through it in depth, it provides little assurance, particularly for those exposed in early pregnancy. The study presents falsely reassuring statistics related to the risk of spontaneous abortion in early pregnancy. Since the majority of women in the calculation were exposed to the mRNA product after the outcome period was defined, 20-week gestation. Remember, we talked about all of this stuff, specifically in the Pfizer study, before we even got to that information. It says, in this article, we draw attention to these errors and recalculate the risk of this outcome based on the cohort that was exposed to the vaccine before 20-week gestation. Our reanalysis indicates a cumulative incidence of spontaneous abortion 7 to 8 times higher than the original author's results. And the typical average for pregnancy loss during that time period, 7 to 8 times higher than normal. That means in translation, if that is accurate based on what they're showing you, 7 to 8 times higher than your normal occurrence of abortion. So you have a 7 to 8 times higher risk of losing your baby. Yeah, that matters. In light of these findings, key policy decisions have been made using unreliable and questionable data. We conclude that the claims made using these data on the safety of exposure of women in early pregnancy to mRNA-based vaccines to prevent COVID-19 are unwarranted and recommend that those policy decisions be revisited. Glad to know that there are some honest people out there fighting for you. Well, sadly enough, let's finish off with going through some of these side effects that we're seeing in adults as they're giving this to children. Manipulating the substance itself, telling you that they're going to change the whole thing anyway, right? Reduce the size of it, manipulate it, and all without any real actual trials again, other than testing them on children in real time or people ongoing for the 2022 studies that continue to 2022, 2023. Like, this needs to not continue on top of that on emergency authorization trial. That needs to have its own safety trial if you're changing what it is. And they know that. But let's take a look at some of these things. This is actually pretty sad. Poor young girl collapses after the gene therapy in Israel, and all those people standing like it's all just not my business.
Zemi Pfizer.
That's, you get the gist of it right there. The point is exactly what Dr. McCullough was saying, right? I mean, you see an endless stream of these people collapsing at the location and giving, you know, dying there, getting CPR on the floor of a Walgreens, and we go, we don't know for sure. Or yet otherwise prove it's not. None of these have been proven to be injections, related to injections. That's what the CDC is continuing to say. Here's another one that's really horrifying. After taking the Pfizer shot, look at her face. This is the blood. This is the blood and platelets and these kind of manipulations we've been seeing everywhere. That's my assessment, I guess, by looking at it. But it's pretty messed up. And as James Lyons-Weiler points out, that's her new normal. It's all good, though. Keep putting in the kids' arms, right? Here's something that'll blow your mind. So here we are. This is the Queensland government in Australia. They're telling you, no, we don't. It's super rare. Adverse events are super rare. You're right. It's all super rare, and it's all safe and effective, right? Well, here's their page on side effects. I'll share the person who shared this next with his comment. Here's what it says at the bottom. Of course, at the bottom. Due to the large number of adverse events, super rare though, being reported throughout Queensland, we are unable to routinely contact every reporter individually. Oh, okay. So they're at least admitting here, which Pfizer won't do, what the FDA won't do, that they're not investigating every single claim, yet somehow simultaneously dismissing all of them as unverified or saying that we don't know or they're not related. We know no deaths have been associated with it. Yet they're telling you right there, we're literally unable to do so. Where have you heard that before? I've been telling you that from the beginning. They simply do not have the resources. It goes on to say, someone from the public health unit in your area may contact you or your health provider if they require more information for reporting and surveillance purposes. If you have any concerns about ongoing symptoms or future vaccinations, please speak to your GP or healthcare provider. Well, exactly as the person who shared this with me points out, seeking science in the lockdown, rare, but there's too many to get back to. Right. This is the kind of contradiction that we just pretend is not there in the COVID clown world. It's super rare, 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 but we just don't have the time to get to all of them. Ridiculous. And here we go with Sophie Ellsworth, media writer at The Australian and Sky News, you know, that fantastically, I can't even say it with a straight face, with that ridiculous propaganda rag outlet. It says, Victorian officials refuse to release vaccination status of virus deaths. Refuse to release vaccination status of the people dying. Now, why would that be? Well, as I said, this is very clear. Either they don't want you to know that most of those dying are double jabbed, which that's happening, what's happening based on their data, or they don't want the conspiracy theorists, in quote, to have ammunition. Either way, they're willfully hiding truthful information from you. Let's make sure that is the point that you take away from that. I don't care why you think they're doing it. They're going, we're not going to show you facts because of what those facts could be used for. That's literally what they're saying, or rather what they're doing. This is the world they're creating where that's acceptable, where we're going to hide the facts. What about that? What if this was in a wartime situation? Well, I guess we really are, to be quite honest. The war is in your body. But what if this was a situation with some kind of drone strike or something overseas, right? We're going to refuse to release who was responsible for that because those anti-war protesters may use it against us. That's what's happening right here. Unreal. But it's all safe and effective, though, as they hide everything and lack transparency in every possible way. But it's all safe and effective. It's all good for you. Well, to finish up here today, guys, Denise Rancourt points out, one of the greatest medical researchers of our time, and this is Stephanie Sanoff, which, see, again, definitely following her from before, and I'm not following her now. You all see that happening with me and everybody else. It's crazy how that keeps going. Penned this powerful article in May. Now, here I include this. You can read it for yourselves, but I just want to clip what he shared with you right here. Unprecedented. Really important to think about as we go forward, especially with the children. Many aspects of COVID-19 and subsequent vaccine development are unprecedented. Let me do this. Dang it. I don't like promoting Twitter as much as I can, a little again. Many aspects of the COVID-19 and subsequent vaccine development are unprecedented for a vaccine deployed for use in the general population. Some of these include the following. Now, we've gone over all of these, but I like that it's in a nice little handy-dandy sheet. First, to use polyethylene glycol in an injection. Right? So all of these are first unprecedented situations, and they're still being tested, and yet they're using these in children right now. First ever to use polyethylene glycol. Which is what James Lyons-Weiler pointed out right in the beginning of all this before it happened, saying this is going to hurt people. 70% of the population, as even Twitter, as Wikipedia puts it, can it be allergic to this? Well, we used it anyway, because they needed to. First to use mRNA vaccine technology against an infectious agent. First time Moderna has brought any product to market. First to have public health officials telling those receiving the vaccination to expect an adverse reaction. Think about how that is the first time they've ever been like, you are going to get one. Think about what that tells you. First to be implemented publicly with nothing more than preliminary efficacy data. First vaccine to make no clear claims about reducing infections, transmissibility, or deaths. First coronavirus vaccine ever attempted in humans. First injection of genetically modified polynucleotides in the general population. But sure glad we're giving this to children, though. Make sure you read this for yourself. Thank you for tuning in today, guys. This stuff needs to get out there. These things need to be discussed. And I'm sure they will. Please help me get it out there. Please continue to take a stand because it's all there. It's all right there in front of us. And it's just about reaching those people that are refusing to see it. Now, some of them will be forever digging their feet in because they don't care about truth and they never really have, whether they realize it or not. All they care about is being on the right side, right? Politically winning and getting a victory against the other bad guy's side. And it's a game, even though they don't realize it. But I believe most people out there are showing enough discernment to be able to change their opinion if it is right in front of them. And it's just about continuing to help me and help you and help everybody around us have the tools, the resources to continue that fight. It is going to continue until we stop it. So keep standing up. I love you all for being here and continuing to fight this battle with me. As always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
Tonight, keeping drug companies honest, a story that's simply stunning about multi-million dollar profits and illegal activity at this country's biggest drug company.
The Justice Department alleges Johnson & Johnson boosted sales by paying millions of dollars in kickbacks to pharmacists and doctors who pushed the drug Risperdal to patients who did not need it.
The medical editors of that journal accused the drug company Merck of misleading them about the dangers of Vioxx, of hiding the fact that it caused even more heart attacks than previously known.
Johnson & Johnson paid $2.2 billion. Eli Lilly paid $1.4 billion. Pfizer and its subsidiary paid $2.3 billion. And GlaxoSmithKline paid out a record $3 billion.
For 7 years, Glaxo failed to report data showing its best-selling diabetes drug, Avandia, increased the risk of heart attack by as much as 40%.
Opioid epidemic has killed more than 400,000 Americans. Tonight, Purdue agreeing to pay more than $8 billion in penalties.
Antidepressant Paxil wasn't approved for use by patients under 18. The company illegally marketed the drug for use by children, even when a clinical trial found teenagers who took the drug for depression were more likely to commit suicide than those taking a placebo.
Purdue Pharma pleading guilty to felony charges of defrauding federal health agencies and violating federal kickback laws for inducing doctors to prescribe those powerful opioids.
Glaxo also hired a company to write a medical journal article downplaying the risks. The firm used PR firms and paid several doctors, including the U.S. celebrity doctor, Drew Pinsky, to promote the drug.
If you can't trust medical research that gets published in very established journals, what can you trust?
But as Bob Orr reports, the massive settlement may not lead to much change.
Is fraud the business model of the pharmaceutical industry?
No one's going to jail. No one's going to prison. And worse yet, they've set up a situation where Purdue's going to be able to continue on.
You look at this thing, and I mean, if Pfizer is too big to fail, and even the biggest fine in history is just a few months' profit, then what's going to stop it from illegally promoting other drugs?
Critics say Anderson, nothing.